categories in particular where states scored pretty well on the budget process, whether citizens have access to the budget process, whether they have input, whether there are adequate checks and balances. And a majority of states actually got Bs or better there. Another category is internal auditing. So for the most part, states have pretty good systems in place to kind of look at their own books and to make sure that agencies are not wasting money. So these are important aspects of government operation that there is good news on.
Well, this is the second time, I guess, that you've done this. What's the trajectory? Are things in general terms getting better or getting worse, did you find?
First of all, the scores aren't directly comparable. We did a number of changes to the project to improve it, to make it more rigorous. For example, we got rid of two categories. Redistricting, for example, takes place once every 10 years, so we didn't want to do that again. And we also added some questions here and there to address evolving issues like independent campaign spending. That said, there has seemed to be a trend in a number of states toward increasing secrecy. There have been reforms here and there, but the public records laws are getting older, and as that happens, exemptions seem to be tacked on, and agencies increasingly tend to use them rather than to provide records, but to block records.
Finally, one of your sources who works on state ethical issues had, you know, I think a very, maybe even the takeaway comment, which was, it's very, very difficult for legislatures to focus on these things and improve them because they don't want these laws. They don't want to enforce them, and they don't want to fund the people enforcing them. I mean, it really sounds like a system where lots of folks are benefiting except regular citizens.
There's definitely some difficult incentives built into it when you have people responsible for creating the laws that are going to oversee themselves. There isn't a lot of momentum often to make changes. And generally, you don't see big changes happening, with rare exception, without major scandals. You saw that in Virginia with former Governor Robert McDonnell being convicted. They passed some laws, which advocates have said are somewhat limited, but nonetheless, they passed some real reform measures there on gifts and creating a new ethics commission there. But it often does take a big scandal.
Well, and I guess that kind of brings us back to journalists, because it's often reporters who do the digging that brings those things to light. So I guess that's part of the reason, as you've said, that you really hope that journalists will not just read this, but take it up and use it, right? Use this and carry the story forward.
We want to bring these issues to light, and we also want this to be a resource for people, for reporters across the country.
We've been speaking with Nicholas Kuznets of the Center for Public Integrity. You can check your state's report card on the state integrity investigation at their website, publicintegrity.org. Nicholas Kuznets, thank you very much for joining us on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good evening, KBOO listeners. The time is now 6:02 and 13 seconds, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Bread and Roses, right after a word from our special KBOO volunteers.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for two positions. We are hiring a membership director. This is a part-time position, 32 hours per week, $15.11 per hour. We're also hiring a PM News and Public Affairs Director. This is a salary full-time position paying $31,400 a year. The full job descriptions and instructions for applying can be found on our website on the homepage on the right-hand side under News from the BOO. That's at kboo.fm on the homepage, right-hand side, under News from the BOO. Applications are due Friday, November 20th at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute Concert Thursday, November 19th, 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. Joe Hill was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World and wrote the classic labor songs There Is Power in a Union, The Rebel Girl, and many more. Joe Hill was executed by the state of Utah 100 years ago and will be remembered with a concert featuring Anne Finney, Citizen Band, and General Strike. Again, that's the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute, Thursday, November 19th, at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven cooperative striving to provide access to whole foods customers can trust. People's features farm-direct organic produce, bulk foods, a weekly year-round farmers market, and everyone is welcome. Located on 21st and Tibbetts Street between Division and Powell. More information at peoples.coop.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and our engineer tonight is Abenizi. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists. We give voice to those working for social justice and equity, globally and locally, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All of this, and we have fun. We always welcome new collective members, no experience necessary. To find out more about how you can host, produce, or engineer with us, you can contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org. Make sure to like Bread and Roses on Facebook to get updates and see behind-the-scenes photos. We are also on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio and on the web at kboo.fm/breadandroses. Tonight, the show focuses on the school-to-prison pipeline. We'll discuss the long history of youth disenfranchisement in communities of color, gang culture, institutionalized zero-tolerance policies in schools, and the consequences for our collective future. Last week, I had the privilege to attend and record a presentation by Carlos Chavez, Executive Director of Morpheus Youth Project, to an Inside Out capstone class at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. Carlos spoke to a class of college students, some visiting from PSU and some living at McLaren, about the long history of disenfranchisement of Latino and African American youth in Los Angeles to contextualize both the creation of gangs and the inappropriate responses of schools and education departments across the country to the reality of school-age youth in communities of color. Carlos Chavez is a KBOO volunteer and a member of the Prison Pipeline Collective, a show that airs every Monday at 6:30 p.m. on KBOO. He is also the executive director of Morpheus Youth Project, Transformation Through Arts and Awareness. Morpheus Youth Projects hopes to create an accessible, safe, and respectful environment that encourages positive growth and provides creative opportunities through the arts and humanities. In partnership with KBOO, Carlos has taught radio journalism at McLaren for 5 years, and Carlos and the youth produce a segment called McLaren Community Voice that airs on Prison Pipeline. Morpheus Youth Project has an event tonight starting at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza Pub, so join them for a night of music, breakdancing, and celebration if you're up for it. Find out more about the event and about their mission at morpheusyouth.org. Here,
the first thing that
Carlos
I like to
Chavez.
Kind of focus on is just, first of all, just kind of breaking stereotypes and different misconceptions about what. You know, what the origins of gangs are, what the origins of, you know, what are the reasons that people usually join gangs, stuff like that, is, you know, I would say the most important thing, just in a nutshell, to know about gang structure, gang culture, is that kind of the commonalities that contribute to it, you know, the underlining thing or the bottom line basically is that it usually stems from poverty. It usually stems from some form of trauma or multiple forms of trauma. It usually stems from being isolated and being marginalized. So those are like three major things that contribute to being to why young people step into this lifestyle. You know, gang activity doesn't represent everything that goes on, you know, for why people end up incarcerated. You know, there are other things that young people do that land them here. And I think one misconception is that everyone here is affiliated with some kind of gang or something like that. That's not how it is. I mean, so I kind of, with this presentation, I focus a lot of history. I focus on Los Angeles gang history, and I'm focused on black and brown gangs. But my disclaimer is that, you know, this isn't meant to kind of represent what that looks like in general. Here in the Northwest, the largest gang structure that there is are white gangs. All right, so that's a big misconception. A lot of people focus their attention on black and brown gangs. There's a lot of media hype that goes around that. There's a lot of and there's just a lot of focus in general. Black and brown folks have been made the boogeymen, and that's one of the biggest things that I'm trying to kind of explain in this presentation here is how does all that start, but also the media has really done a lot to. They've been very irresponsible in the way that they've represented, you know, who these people are, and so that's kind of what I really kind of want to focus on. The other thing is that you know, what a lot of people don't know is that you know, gangs have been around for a long time, and like I said, there's a lot of focus on black and brown gangs, but white gangs are actually the ones who started most of it. They either started the gangs that some of the black and brown folks are involved in today, or they had an influence on how those gangs started. Okay, not to demonize white culture or anything like that, but you know, two major contributing factors to this whole thing is racism and inequality. You know, economic inequality. You know what I mean? Poverty. That's what a lot of this stuff stems from. If you go back to the origins of any of this stuff, it's going to bring you back to those two things or those other things that I had mentioned before when it comes on to an individual basis. So the first thing that I talk about is so in the first half of this, it's about kind of the Latino perspective, Mexican perspective, and then the other side is from the African-American perspective, you know, where some of the origins of those things came from. What you're seeing here is a map of the American Southwest. Most of this here used to be Mexico, okay? You know, especially when you're talking about like the West Coast and the Southwest area, there was a lot of segregation that went on initially, all right, in the United States, that pushed in the major cities, pushed black and brown folks, usually the brown folks, into the east side areas, and black folks into like the south side or east side area. But usually the west side was something that was set up for folks that were living in the more middle income, you know, white neighborhoods. The segregation was very real during these periods of time. You know, you couldn't, if you were a person of color, you couldn't live outside of these areas. If you stepped outside of these areas, police would round you up and they would bring you back into these areas. Or you would be, if they didn't bring you back to these areas, they would take you to jail. So that was the other thing. As far as Mexicanos goes, a lot of the culture that the gang structure that you see today comes from, it had its origins in the Pachuco culture, which was during the 1940s. But a lot of these youth, and basically what it is, what we're looking at with the Pachucos was, we're looking at youth that were starting to create an identity of their own. And much in the same way, to tell you the truth, that African-American youth were going through a very similar thing. But with Chicanos, you had youth who were part of two different worlds. You had youth that were part of the, you know, their families came from Mexico, were born and raised in Mexico. And you have youth that are born and being, or at a really early age, being raised in the United States. So they're growing up under these two different types of cultures. You know, these they're they're learning how to be, how to, they're being influenced by American culture, whereas their parents were influenced by something that was more of a traditional Mexican culture. And so there's this weird kind of place that you get put into, where you're a part of both, but you're not truly accepted by both. So out of that came this new identity that Chicano youth started to put together during the 1940s, which was the whole Pachuco culture. And it's in some ways it's very similar to what we see in more recent history with the hip hop culture. You know, there's a language that's all its own. There's a style of dress. There's an attitude. There are other elements that go into this culture that, you know, that many people outside of the culture don't understand. And if you listen to the old Pachuco music, which it was like a version of swing music. It was like a Chicano version of swing, because that was a very influential thing on the Pachucos during that time. That was very popular. It wasn't something that their parents listened to or participated in. That was actually kind of a new phenomenon during that time, during the 1940s. And so you had black clubs where there was swing going on, like in Central Avenue in Los Angeles. There was a whole section of town, which we'll get to in a second, where that was going on. But then there was also in the east side, in the Boyle Heights area and near downtown Chavez Ravine, Chicanos were going to little, you know, hops or whatever, you know, little dance halls where they would go and they would dance swing and stuff like that. So, but in that music, you'll hear these stories. You can hear these stories, and it's spoken in the language Caló, which was basically a dialect that the Pachucos created all their own. It was a way that they could kind of dance between those two worlds in a way that they only understood. I mean, you had to be a Pachuco. You had to speak that language in order to identify with somebody else who spoke that language and to be a part of that world. Otherwise, you were outside of it, and you were recognized as being outside of it. We talk about the word gang, but this is an important piece that I forgot to even mention in the beginning. That language, the word gang, is something that's really important to kind of dissect and take a look at. You know, what is it? What are we talking about when we're talking about the word gang? What does that mean, and what are the visuals that typically come to mind right offhand, and why is that? You know what I mean, the word gang is not usually something that people take on themselves. That they when these kids started to band together and started to create these groups, they didn't do it with the intention to form a gang. It wasn't their intention at all. They banded together for a variety of different reasons, but it was mainly for camaraderie and to be together. It was to have a family of some kind. You know what I mean? And the term gang is something that the outside society that didn't understand the gang structure put on those youth. And that has always been the scenario since pretty much the beginning of time. So all the different structures that have popped up over time, it's always been the youth or the young people that have been involved in it, who started it, you know, either for an economic reason or for that family element or for, but in a lot of times they started up as a form of protection. For example, you had White Fence, which is a gang that's still around today. But and White Fence there was a White Fence that went around and also divided this area that was around this church called Purísima Church that was in the Boyle Heights area. And the youth that hung out there, they used to call them the Purísima crowd, because that church is what they were kind of connected to. And the young Chicanos that lived there used to play baseball and play sports there, and kind of got well known because they were really good athletes that were kind of growing up in that area, and that was their area that they used to hang out. And their little siblings would go to school just outside of this area, just outside of where that church was. And as they would go to school, they would get beat up by a lot of the white gangs that were in the area. Or I wouldn't say a lot of the white gangs. There were certain groups of white kids, because they would be walking through the white neighborhoods, some white neighborhoods, in order to get to this elementary school that they went to. They were getting beat up going to school. And what ended up happening was that the teenage boys, the kids that were in middle school, the kids that were in high school, you know, they of course didn't want their little brothers and sisters getting beat up by these other folks. So they would escort the kids into the other neighborhood so that they could go to school safely. And so they then got recognized as being, you know, pretty tough for being able to handle and protect their siblings going to elementary school. So out of that kind of camaraderie, Eventually, that kind of turned into something else. But initially, that's what it came out of. That's what it grew up out of. It was a form of protection. It was a way for these young people to come together and protect their siblings. And so, and that many times is the story for a lot of youth. But these are just two sections of town in Los Angeles where a lot of that started. One of them was in an area called Chavez Ravine, which is no longer there. The area was bulldozed, and it was cleared out for housing development that was going to be put up there, but eventually became Dodger Stadium. The housing development fell through, and Dodger Stadium ended up being the place that those folks lived in. But and what's really interesting is that story is very similar to the one of the stories that we have in Portland with the Coliseum going up in that downtown area, and also where that Rose Garden area is today. That used to be the black neighborhood of Portland, and the same type of thing happened where this population was then pushed out into an area. Before they got to Alberta, there was an area like along Williams, kind of south of that area where they were at, and then they got pushed out once again from that area because of a hospital being put in, and because of other freeway entrances and exits that were being put in along that I-5 right there. So then they got pushed out into Alberta, and then from Alberta, everyone's been getting pushed out east, out into the numbers. And one of the reasons that, like, the work that we focus on, that my organization focuses on out in East Portland, is because of that. Is because we know the first thing I did was I went to the gang task force meetings to find out, where are the young people that I want to be connected with? Where are they? Where are the ones that are getting involved in these different things? And I found out very quickly that the East Side is where that was happening. And this was one of the reasons that was happening is because of marginalization that was going on with this young population of people being pushed out of their original communities, their home communities. So those are very major factors when we're talking about these things. So this is what the Pachucos looked like back in the day. They had their own style. They had their own language. They had their own identity that they created. But at the time, this is World War II era, and this was a very, like, overly patriotic time. This was also a time when Japanese internment took place. So the racial tensions were really, really high during this time. Segregation was still very real at this time. So for the young Chicanos to be creating an identity like this, for many of the population, was an eyesore. People didn't like it. And so they became a demonized portion of society. During the 1950s, the Zoot Suit actually got banned in Los Angeles. It was actually something that got banned. It represented something that everybody saw as, dirty, as ugly. And the politicians got on board with this. And, the environment was very toxic. There was a police chief that was brought in from the South named Chief Parker, I think it was. And he was from the South, very racist. And he recruited many other officers from the South. And the first thing that they started doing was rounding up young black and brown folks for very minor infractions. And the Zoot Suit just became, a symbol and justification for doing what they had done. That was the first time that Los Angeles jails and prisons really started to kind of balloon, especially with disproportionate amounts of black and brown people. So Pachucos were some of the ones who were really rounded up during that time. Because of the banning of the Zoot Suit and because of the demonization of that whole identity, that whole form of identity, youth started to kind of take on something else. They kind of handed in the Zoot Suits and started to take on more of, during these periods of time, it was very much a blue collar era. So you had, back then you would have like working man emporiums, that would be a place where you would go to purchase your clothing. You could get clothing there for the military, for any kind of union job that you had. And basically what the clothing was, it was Dickies, it was Ben Davis, it was the white t-shirts, it was the button-up shirts, it was all that kind of stuff. The youth culture, a lot of that was very similar to what the Zoot Suit looked like, with the creases, with the pleats, with the very clean and sharp look. So that was something that was continued to be kind of adopted. But there was, you know, there was three places that the pachucos would end up. Like I said, they would either end up in jail. A lot of them became mechanics, and that's where the lowrider culture had come out of. And a lot of them went into the military. So like I said, that form, that attire, that uniform was something that then kind of got adopted and then carried on. So if you see a lot of Chicano like youth today, you know that you'll see a lot of those styles that still kind of exist today. But it all came from the pachucos originally. It was all part of youth trying to create something that they took ownership of, on their, you know, something that was their own, you know, a way for them to kind of have their own, create their own identity. So that's what it all kind of stems from. Whether, and today what's interesting is that a lot of youth, they just learn this from, you know, elders, you know, older cousins, older brothers and sisters. They wore that clothing, and so that kind of passes on, and they kind of adopt a new, like, modern style, you know, that they kind of tack onto it. So a lot of times they don't really know what these origins are, but when you, a lot of times when I tell this story, the pachuco story, it connects the dots for a lot of young people. You know? So now we look at kind of the African American perspective on things. How did African Americans even end up in many of, you know, what we see today as inner cities? How did Watts become such a very much a black neighborhood? Now it's very much a Latino neighborhood, but still has a strong black presence there. But how did that happen? We had two periods of time of the Great Migration, and the later era of the Great Migration was during that kind of World War II era, where you had World War I and World War II era, where you had very many of the black communities that were moving out of the South to to escape racism, unfortunately to run right back into it when they went to these cities. This was also the industrial era, like the boom of the industrial era. So we had factories all over the place. People were moving to these areas so that they could get these factory jobs. And black and brown folks were able to get these jobs. So they were able to actually make a living for themselves and escape a lot of the style of racism that happened here. But as I said, they did run into another form of it when they went to these other. Like I said, these are the factories that many of the African Americans were working in. You had Firestone, you had rubber plants, steel plants, railroad. It was all these different things that were popping up, and it was the railroad that brought many of the folks out. Unfortunately, for the African American population that ended up in Los Angeles, the farthest west that anyone can go if they were black was Central Avenue, which was basically dead center in Los Angeles. And so what ended up happening is that the black population was segregated into South Los Angeles. So Watts, Florence, basically this whole section right here. All of this was white suburbs, all right? But this little section here, South Los Angeles, was where the black population ended up. This is just to, you know, just to point out how segregation was very, very real at the time. This is a movie theater showing, you know, dates and times and costs. Mexican night was Wednesdays and color night was Thursdays. So there were housing covenants during the time that because of those covenants, black and brown folks were not able to move into other areas of the city. And so Compton was one of those areas that was white. It was a white, you know, residential, middle class area, suburban area. There was the federal government, the Supreme Court had basically ruled that covenants were no longer lawful, and that was something that had to be removed. Because of that, folks that were working in those industries, that were making a decent living for themselves, started moving out into these suburban areas. And so the first black families that moved into these areas, the families were very upset with black families moving into these areas. And so what ended up happening is many of the youth got targeted by gangs that were in the area. Like, there was a Southgate gang called the Spook Hunters. They used to wear a leather jacket, and on the back of the leather jacket was a black man hanging from a noose. And they used to drive around in cars looking for young kids stepping outside of their neighborhood so that they can rough them up and send them back to where they came from. So you can imagine youth moving into this area. They encountered an amazing amount of brutality when they first came into these neighborhoods. And so one of the first groups who kind of banded together of youth kind of created a club that they called the Slossons. And they named that after the park that they lived by. Slosson Park was a park. And there were three other clubs that had kind of popped up during the time. Now, keep in mind, they called these clubs. They didn't call these gangs. They called them clubs. And at the time, they couldn't go to the clubs that the white kids were able to go to. They couldn't go to the Boys and Girls Club. They couldn't join the Boy Scouts. They were excluded from those things, so they created clubs of their own. All right? That was at the root of where this stuff came from. All right? And so you had other groups such as the Gladiators, the Farmers, and the Businessmen. Those are the four original clubs that were in the area, in that little kind of South Central area of Los Angeles that started to kind of pop up. And they made a name for themselves because they fought off other gangs like the Spook Hunters and the Hells Angels were two of the main ones that really went after these youth. Throughout the 70s, these industries completely went away. They started moving. I don't know if during that time they started moving overseas, but they started being shut down all over the place. And completely, by the 1980s, they were gone. They were just totally gone. So a lot of the places that employed a lot of these young black and brown families no longer was there. And then that was a time also when a lot of drugs, like heroin, was starting to come into the cities. During the 1980s, cocaine and, cocaine started to come, especially in Los Angeles, really started to flood the streets. There's a whole section of history, which is very important, but those are kind of at the root of that whole drug war history. The United States was actually involved in bringing a lot of that over here. And unfortunately, a lot of that ended up in the inner cities in Los Angeles. And so the Slossons, they actually had kind of gotten involved in the political organizations in the 60s, like the Black Panther Party. The chapter, Bunchy Carter was somebody who was initially a Slosson, well-known general of the Slosson Club, who ended up becoming the lead figure of the LA chapter of the Black Panther Party. And they worked on creating free breakfast programs, free dental clinics, free sickle cell anemia testing for because that was an issue back then, dealing with that. Free services for the community because they saw that the community was lacking those things. And so in those black communities, Black Panthers were responsible for putting that together. You usually don't hear that when you hear it. It's not until more recently that the true history of what the Black Panther Party was involved in has really gotten out there. But up until that point, they've just been demonized. But they were actually working to help better the community. The Slossons became a big part of that in Los Angeles. This is something to look up and to do some research on if you don't know anything about it, but the COINTELPRO program, counterintelligence program that the FBI put together, which was basically an illegal program that went on. It's COINTELPRO, COINTELPRO was the acronym for that program. And they went after these civil rights groups, like the Black Panther Party was like their primary target. They went after people like Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X. They were actually involved in the assassination of Malcolm X. Many believe also Martin Luther King Jr. I don't know that we have enough classified material to really make that distinction or not, but it's a very important piece of history. And that plays a very significant role in how the gang structure has popped up. That's a very important piece of history.
They took those role models away from the community.
They did. So the leaders that originally were part of this, that were doing a lot of this community activism, they got killed, they got derailed, they got exiled, they were jailed. So they were taken off out of the communities. So now all you had was peers mentoring peers, youth mentoring youth. They no longer had that guidance of the wisdom of the elders that were leading and providing the leadership. They weren't able to articulate themselves in the same way. So that whole community effort ended up getting derailed. Then it was about survival. It was a survival mode that everyone kicked into. And the young people started to recognize very quickly that drugs was able to provide an economic means to solve that problem. And so that is one of the big reasons why things took on such a different direction. You know, we forget history really easy. We don't focus any attention on history. History is so important for us understanding what we're going to do next to break cycles that are unhealthy from the past. If we continue to just ignore history and just move forward, we're going to continue to repeat the same thing over and over and over again. If we never understood what happened before, how are we going to understand how to deal with what we're facing next time it comes around? And it comes around every single time. History always repeats itself. So if you understand it, you're going to have better tools to deal with it when it comes back around. But another thing that I wanted to kind of have an open discussion about is now what happens with this institution where the institution is starting to look like a gang structure. I mean, think about the zero tolerance policy. What is that about? Zero tolerance policy that's happening in schools, being tough. Well, what are you teaching them? You're bullying the kids and you're telling them not to bully others. How does that work? You're teaching them the very things that you're complaining that they're getting involved in. So the next step that I was going to kind of talk about is that whole school to prison pipeline scenario that's going on. With what I do, with the work that I do, I'm in a unique perspective. I'm at a middle school out in Gresham. I get to other middle schools as well. I work at a number of different schools in East Portland. I've been at Madison. I've been at David Douglas High School. I've been at, which are all on the east side. I do stuff at Fir Ridge Alternative High School, so I also have that perspective. I've done stuff over at Portland Youth Builders Alternative High School, so I can see what the diaspora looks like. I see what the color of students are. What are the disparities that the youth are that they're facing? But I also see what the schools, what the institution is doing with this whole zero tolerance policy and with them trying to meet numbers. You know, with this whole, you know, testing style of education that we're working into, the state standards and what have you, the schools are missing the point now. Now what they're ending up doing is they're using the justification of these gang structures and what have you to, you have folks coming in from the county explaining to the teachers and to the administrators, how do we identify gangs in your school? What are they teaching them how to do? They're teaching them how to profile, how to racially profile kids. What are the styles of clothing that these kids are wearing? Oh, okay, that means that they're gang members. That's basically what they're telling these people. And so that's how they learn to, because these are people that are not within the gang culture. They don't understand what that gang culture looks like and feels like. So they don't know how to identify this stuff. They just know that there's a problem. And they're not getting to the root of the problem. They're looking at the symptoms. And so they're not really addressing what's going on. And what they do as a school, because they want to get their funding next year, is they push these kids out that aren't reaching their goals, that aren't getting the numbers that they want. So these black and brown students that are, you know, kids that aren't showing up in school, that are having behavioral issues, kids that are having, and behavioral, that all stems from these traumatic scenarios. They're acting out because they don't have something at home. You know, and it could just be something as simple as, you know, a lot of the middle schoolers that I work with, I have a group of middle schoolers that I work with right now. These are the ones that all the school are focusing their attention on and they're nervous about. They're getting rid, they always want to kick these kids out of the school and get rid of them. And I don't know why they think that that's going to resolve the problem. First of all, why can't they deal with that? I mean, why can't they deal with behavior in the classroom? Why do they have to bring in police officers to deal with that and then to start criminalize the behavior that's normal behavior for many of these youth? Kids getting into a fist fight shouldn't then become a misdemeanor. You know what I mean? They shouldn't be getting records when they're in middle school and even in elementary school. There's elementary school kids that they talk about trying to send to the alternative schools. What? So I'm in this unique position where I get to see all this stuff going on.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to a presentation by Carlos Chavez, Executive Director of Morpheus Youth Project, to an Inside Out capstone class at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. Carlos spoke to a class of college students, some visiting from PSU and some living at McLaren, about the long history of disenfranchisement of Latino and African American youth in Los Angeles, to contextualize both the creation of gangs and the inappropriate response of schools and education departments across the country to the reality of school-age youth in communities of color. We will now play an interview I conducted with Carlos right after he gave this presentation, where he discusses the presence of police in schools, zero tolerance policies, and the work that his organization, Morpheus Youth Project, does to support youth and prevent further alienation. Here is Carlos Chavez.
You know, it doesn't take a scientist or an analyst to recognize that, you know, having police officers in the school automatically is gonna you know, create this criminalized, you know, situation. Now the students are no longer just having behavioral issues that can be dealt with in the classrooms by the teachers and by the staff members. The staff members now just don't even want to deal with it, and they're going to push that off to police officers, who are then going to deal with it the way that they know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And that's to handcuff them, to restrain them, and to eventually throw them in jail. Sometimes, you know, ending up in extremely violent situations, which is happening more and more and more often across the country. Mm-hmm.
How is it, in your opinion, that we ended up there, like having cops in the schools?
My understanding of the history is, you know, during the 80s and 90s is when, you know, you have kind of a variety of different things that are going on during the 80s and 90s. You have a lot of resources that are being taken out of the schools. During the Reagan administration, a lot of that was taking place, where you had a lot of the social programs, the arts programs, and that's at the beginning of where a lot of it. Actually, even Nixon was doing this stuff too. Mm-hmm. But even the Democrats have got on board with a lot of that, and taking away resources that were valuable to the youth that were in these schools and to the schools themselves, removing counselors, removing and focusing most of the attention on math, science, and English, and just completely removing you know, physical ed and music and arts and the things that actually get more of the brain lit up and active when in the learning environment. So these things are being taken out, and at the same time, everyone's coming up with a zero tolerance policy because they're seeing a rise in gang activity and youth, what they see, you know, what they call youth delinquency. But, you know, when you're taking away those resources, well, that's the kind of the natural occurrence, is that kids are going to now start getting involved in these different things. Mm-hmm. And especially when you start adding drugs to the scene and all these other elements, and you have, you know, policing, where in the streets, in these communities where these kids live, where they're profiling kids based on their race and their class, and when they're brutally doing, you know, harassment and brutalizing some of the kids that are in these neighborhoods and family members, they're seeing this stuff happen. And so so what ends up happening, wow, is they take that from the street and they start moving that into the classroom. And so with the zero, what they start creating is a get tough on crime and zero tolerance policies in the classroom. They start bringing this whole tough guy attitude of, yeah, you know, we're tougher and bigger and stronger as an institution than you are as a student. And that's how we're going to deal with this, is basically they decide that they're going to start bullying the students. And as a way to kind of, so the way that they do it is they, and now what you're seeing in the media is you're seeing people present this whole idea of having police in the schools and in the classrooms as, oh, well, they're there to protect you. You know, we have all these school shootings going on and this stuff like that. And the police are there to protect the students, when in actuality, they're not even being trained to do that. You know, they're a lot of times not, they're not being trained as educators. You know, they haven't been trained as educators. Many of them haven't gone through any of that schooling. And a lot of them haven't been trained on how to restrain students with, you know, a non, you know, violent or a non-physical type of restraint. They're not being trained in any of these, in any of these tactics. Mm-hmm. And what they know is to be tough, you know, and to show them that, oh, you think you're a gangster, well, I'm going to show you who the biggest gang is, you know? And so they come in to be tough. Well, at the same time, you know, the administrators are walking around being tough, and they actually are going around and harassing the kids. The schools that I work at, I see the principals and the head disciplinarians, the deans, walking up to these students and provoking situations, going, oh, you know, and demeaning these kids, you know, saying things to them that's you know, very stereotyping the kids and making them feel like they're less than, you know, and in many ways to kind of provoke a situation. And then once the situation has been provoked, they're like, oh, okay, well, we're removing you from the school, or we're going to suspend you, we're going to do all these different things. They're focusing all their attention on certain individuals. Many times, and usually in the majority of the population, are kids of color. They are kids with learning disabilities, and they're kids, they're LGBT, mm-hmm. You know, kids that are other than, you know, that white American mainstream, basically. And so, unfortunately, you get these kids that bear the brunt of these policies. And what's such a contradiction is that you see how they're taking this bullying approach, and they're at the same time telling kids, oh, well, we're doing this Stop the Bullying campaign, and you need to really be focusing on your, you know, the way that you're behaving around other students and stuff. They're learning this stuff from the administrators who are using those same bullying tactics against them in order to control and herd their population of youth, you know, instead of creating teachable moments, you know, taking incidents and using those as opportunities to teach something to the students and to engage and to build relationships with these students that's trusting. I'm finding more and more that there's such a gap between the adults that are in these schools and the students. There's such a disconnect. Students just outright just don't even trust who you know, who's teaching their classes and who is teaching their schools. Not that everyone is this way, but mm-hmm. but there's the gap just widens you know, that disconnect that's happening.
And it also feels that the teachers are just expecting the trust without having to work for it.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, is that you're going to respect me, you know, regardless of the fact that I'm going to be walking around here disrespecting you. But then you bring in that whole other element of policing and criminalizing these youth. You're preparing them for jail. It's a streamlined process that starts to be put into place. And the more and more police officers that you have, you know, the first day of school, you have a police officer meeting you at the door. Well, does that make you feel welcome? You know, what does that make you feel like? And there's a purpose for that. You know, that's an intimidation tactic used to let you know that, hey, we're in control here. You know, you better mind or else. Well, is that the type of environment that you want to create at your school? Is that a healthy learning environment for the students? Or does that just look like the jails that you're preparing them to go to? You know?
So would you talk a little bit about why you started Morpheus Youth Project and how does that fit within the solutions?
Well, I started it because I feel passionate about this type of stuff that I'm talking about. I didn't start this for any political purpose. I started because in some ways I really want to humanize the situation. Yeah. And I want to meet these youth and work with these youth in ways that are very human, you know, and I want to be, instead of being an adult who's pulling himself further away from the youth, trying to immerse myself in what they're involved in and be involved, be a part of a very central part of their community in a way that they trust and that they can support, that they can believe in. You know, I want them to feel like they're important and that they mean something you know, one pattern that you see that no one's doing, well, I don't want to say no one's doing anything about, there are folks that are doing things about this, but not, there's not enough that's being done about it, is that you have students that are from these different demographics and from these different backgrounds that have experienced some extreme form of trauma, usually multiple forms of trauma, who are ending up incarcerated. Instead of going after the symptom, let's go and find out what, how we can get involved and help to treat that trauma. Not that I'm a counselor or anything like that, but, you know, when kids get involved with art and when they are able to build meaningful relationships, they can work through those situations, you know. And some forms of trauma are much more severe, you know. You, and it is important to bring in the professionals who can deal with that. And those people are part of our team. So, I mean, that, I guess that kind of gives you an, maybe a little bit of an idea of kind of what our approach is. But I, you know, I wanted to make sure that we put ourselves in the locations where a lot of these youth are being rounded up. And, you know, I'm trying to run counter to what is going on with a lot of the zero tolerance stuff. And it's very difficult because you have these schools who don't want that. They tell you, oh, can you talk to our students and how can you help out? You know, we got these kids that are acting out and all this type of stuff, but they don't really want to do the things that they really need to do in order to solve those problems.
Yeah.
They just want to throw somebody at it so they don't have to worry about it, you know? So then you become this token person who's there, we're solving the problem. We got this guy, we're throwing at it, you know? And you know, one person can only do so much. And, you know, this is just one little piece of the puzzle. You know, we focus on arts and education. Culture really is what we really bring into the mix. And I focus on, when I'm doing educational stuff, like if it's history related, I'm focusing on stuff that directly relates to these youth that we're working with. Teaching about Chicano studies, African American stories, but also about what's going on in the street culture, you know. Where did these gangs actually really come from, and how did those things really start? It wasn't just some kids who all of a sudden decided one day, oh, we're going to start packing guns and start shooting at people. There's a history behind that, and there's a reason that that happened, and that stems from, you know, disparity and poverty and a variety of other things. But this is how we are able to connect with the kids. They see, we try and create an opportunity where they finally see themselves in the curriculum and in the people that are teaching the curriculum as well, or involved in the stories, you know. And we're taking an approach, you know, the schools don't want to take an approach where they're getting like emotionally involved with the students in any way or building any relationships. It's they're there to present information and then to get scores going and to move on. And to not have any kind of meaningful, that's actually what they're taught, you know, mm-hmm. and how they're expected to perform when they're at schools, instead of building these meaningful relationships that really foster a lot of growth, you know. I mean, I don't know how that whole philosophy came about, but you know, to disengage from the youth in order to build them. I don't know how that works, but, but, you know, my whole philosophy is to really build relationships. Trust is like the key.
Thank you so much, Carlos, for your time.
Most definitely. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I appreciate you.
You are listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to an interview with Carlos Chavez about the school-to-prison pipeline and what his organization, Morpheus Youth Project, does to support youth in the system. You can learn more about Morpheus Youth Project at morpheusyouth.org. And they have an event tonight starting at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza Pub. So join them for a night of music, break dancing, and celebration. Well, for the last few moments of the show, I would like to introduce you to a new project entitled Free as the Sun, Lou's Songs of Life. Rhonda Case, the mother of the late Louis de Bruges, talks to us about this multimedia project to share the music, poetry, song lyrics, essays, and journal writing of Louis, who died last year at age 17. Free as the Sun gives voice to one brilliant young man's experience of traumatic childhood abuse and his sorrows as he struggled with addiction. Learn more at freeasthesun.com. Here is Rhonda Case. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and I am with Rhonda Case. Rhonda, welcome back to Bread and Roses.
Thank you so much, Delphine.
It's a pleasure to have you back again on the show. And today we're talking about a brand new project. It's a new CD, and it's called Free as the Sun, Loose Songs of Life. Tell us about that project. What is it about?
Thanks. I'm really excited to share this with KBOO listeners. So Free as the Sun is a CD, and it's also a companion book to share the music, original songs, and writing of my late son, Louis de Bruges, who passed away in December 2014.
And so tell us about the songs. What are they and the book?
So Louis has four original songs on this CD, and the music producer is Marv Ross. Marv and Rindy Ross of Quarterflash are our guides and huge supporters of this project. They donated a fifth track. So my son's first, the four songs include two with his voice as lead vocalist. Mm-hmm. And then it happens that his bandmate and very best friend, Shay McKinnon, is a very gifted vocalist who did a lot of work when he was young with Michael Allen Harrison. And so we ended up recording at 8 Ball Studio and then at The Trench. So with just Portland's best, with Rob Stroop and Greg Williams, and all of this thanks to Marv Ross. And then the companion book is poetry and essays. And the subjects are difficult but important, mm-hmm. and that is child abuse. My son was a victim of family violence when he was young. Mm-hmm. And we both were, and but he definitely bore the brunt of that, and he bore it bravely as one could. And he wrote a lot the last couple of years of his life. Mm-hmm. And when I began to go through all of the things he had left as a kind of legacy, I realized this really needed to be shared. His voice is important.
Yeah. And so tell us about the birth of this project as actually bringing his voice forth. How did that start?
Thanks, because it's been pretty magical all along the way. Marv Ross and my son and Shay are all Harry Potter fans, and there seems to be some magic in this. So I was actually posting his song lyrics and poetry online on Facebook and some of the archived recordings he had done. And it was a former student of mine from back east, Rachel, who said, you know, this is really good. And my husband has been in publishing and music, and she said, I think it needs to be shared, and we'd love to help with that. And so that was the sort of seed of an idea.
Wow.
I was still in a lot of grief at that point, but it definitely was a seed that was planted. And then a friend, a colleague of mine who has an essay actually in the book, Randy Ellison, with whom I worked for several years in the movement to end child abuse, he knew Marv was going to be doing an interview, and I heard Marv speak about where his own songwriting and music began as a teen, and there was a lot of sadness in his family life. Mm. And so he found music to be therapeutic and a way to express that, and I thought, this is the guy. And then I was just so fortunate, because once he'd read some of, heard Louis' songs and heard Shay sing, he thought so too.
Mm-hmm. And so, what is it, 8 months later?
That's right.
What's the project?
So, this is really well timed for us and for your listeners, because we launched a Kickstarter in October, and it ends the 16th of November. And with that Kickstarter, we are going to have the CD and the book both printed and published. That's our goal, by the end of the year, which would be just a little over a year after my son's death. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah.
So the website for the project is www.freeasthesun.com, sun spelled S-U-N. And through the website, then you can directly go to the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of Lou's song, Free as the Sun.
That's right. That's the title track.
Will be part of the CD.
And so the project is also a way to support folks out there who maybe are working with youth, or maybe have youth in their life, or maybe even are youth themselves who are struggling with some trauma. Talk a little bit about what you hope the whole project accomplish.
Right. That is the really the heart of this, is that we have as a long-term goal getting the book and the CD and the companion book into a variety of therapeutic contexts, because it's a first-person story, it's a young voice, the variety of musical styles. I think everybody's going to find something both in the melodies and in the words to draw them. And
mm-hmm. And so talk about Louis' professional career dream.
Oh, Delphine, thank you. Yeah, so, you know, of course when he and Shay were young, they were just going to be music stars, right? And then, you know, for both of them, too many, not me, but other adults would say, oh, yeah, but you've got to have a backup plan B, you know, right? Even though they were listening to their CDs about music as a business and taking it very seriously. So Louis actually was in community college courses and completed 20 credits, actually.
Wow.
At CCC, and had a lot of success there, and again, some great writing instructors. And he said, you know, I'm finally feeling like I really am as intelligent as people have been telling me all my life. So if you're a victim of abuse, your self-esteem is often down to zero, right? But he said, you know, I really do. I think I could be a counselor. Maybe I could be a psychiatrist, but that's a lot of school. He said, so he told the counselor at CCC he wanted to look at music therapy. Mm-hmm. So this is a beautiful realization of that dream.
Mm-hmm. It really is. Thank you so much, Rhonda, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, good Friday. Welcome.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to an interview with Rhonda Case, the mother of the late Louis de Bruges, about the multimedia project Free Us the Sun. For more information, including how to support their Kickstarter campaign, go to www.freeasthesun.com.
All right, let's try this again.